Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza. I'm an allied healthcare professional that has worked in the industry for over 25 years, with the majority of my practice being in the private physical therapy space and in public school athletics. My curiosity prompted me to create Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast to discuss the ever-changing landscape in the healthcare industry, focusing on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we will discuss the barriers that healthcare professionals face and how we as individuals can collaborate to make the listener better understand the industry for a better patient and athlete experience. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. David Ruckelsman. Dr. Ruckelsman is the chief of the Division of Hand and Upper Extremity Surgery at Newton Wellesley Hospital. He is board certified by the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery and holds a subspecialty certificate of added qualification in surgery of the hand and upper extremity. He is clinical associate professor at Tufts University School of Medicine and a consultant at MGA Harvard Medical School. He is the president and director of the Hand Surgery Research and Educational Foundation, a 501c3, which supports clinical research and education to improve the quality of life for people with afflictions of the hand and upper extremity. He is a hand and wrist sports medicine consultant for the New England Patriots, Boston Cannons, Harvard University, Boston College, and several other regional Division 1 to 3 collegiate programs. He has served as the team physician for the USA National, Macabia ice hockey and basketball teams. He, along with his partners, continue to provide care for the professional athlete, and together they represent a source of initial and second opinions for the injured athlete. Dr. Ruckelsman continues to publish and lecture on hand and wrist injuries unique to the athlete, and recently has published results with his novel technique for fixation of metacarpal fractures, which has allowed athletes to return to play more rapidly. Now on to the show. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week we have Dr. David Ruckelsman from Boston Hand to Shoulder. Formerly of Hand Surgery PC, they're located in Needham, Massachusetts, and Dr. Ruckelsman has been a great addition in the sports medicine field, where we, you know, physical therapy and also athletic trainers with their ailing athletes. So, Dr. Ruckelsman, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, one of the questions I like to ask a lot of the guests is, how do they get into either, you know, physical therapy, athletic training, sports medicine, sports science? What drove you to pursue a career in medicine?
Yeah, we get that from time to time. But my memory always goes back to, the same point in time. And I think, you know, as you know, with your trainees and the people you work with, sometimes it's a singular experience that can have either a wonderful, profound, positive effect or a profoundly negative effect. And you know, my inspiration to go into hand and upper limb surgery really began here in Boston. I came up here in the mid-90s to Boston University, and I enrolled in a gross anatomy class with some graduate students in physical therapy, occupational therapy, and athletic training. And we started with the lower limb, and I found that interesting. But once we got to the upper limb, you know, I felt tremendously inspired by the unique design of the upper limb, and specifically the hand and wrist. And I didn't know anything about hand surgery at that time. I had not had a hand surgery as a former a high school athlete, unfortunately. But I knew I loved the anatomy. So then the question became, well, what do I do with this? And I explored some affiliated fields within the medical space, athletic training and PT. OT, I did some volunteer work down at Boston Medical Center and learned that there was a specialty called hand surgery. And I said, that's what I want to do. And then the question became, well, how do you get there? And I had to do my homework at that point. Yeah. But I remember it like it was yesterday. A lot of the folks I was in class with did not enjoy the small nature of the anatomy in the hand and wrist. And for whatever reason, I was extremely lucky, challenged by it and enjoyed it. That was the start of it.
That's great. That's a great explanation to why. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with, you know, being introduced to something that you weren't certain of what that was going to unfold for you, and then you became, you know, a specialist in the hand. And
you know, this, it goes back to, you know, I'm just going to kind of relate. My daughter went to undergraduate school, wanted to be a marine biologist. And every school she applied to was marine biology, and she got in from marine biology. First semester in marine biology, she's like, I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to be sitting on a boat or sitting behind a lab microscope. She took a class in speech therapy. And that would turn her on to be want to become a speech language pathologist. And now she's looking to work with adults and you know, traumatic brain injury, which is pretty cool, you know. So I guess it opens doors for people when they get to work with different you know, professions in the field of medicine.
Yeah, you know, I would say, you know, for your younger listeners, your high school and even maybe younger, and the people early on in their collegiate careers who'll be tuning in, you know, sometimes it's as important to figure out what you don't want to do as it is what you want to do. And yeah, you got to expose yourself to the breadth of it. You know, you see the folks you probably take care of, you know, and I'm amazed by it with my own children. You know, the blinders are on pretty quickly. Kids these days are so intensely focused, whether it's sports, academics, or a combination thereof. And sometimes it takes a little bit of gentle guidance to say, hey, look, you don't have to know right away. There's this intense pressure to just know immediately.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I tell young athletes the same thing when they come in. They are so laser focused now on what they want to do. And I think it's the exposure to other things during their academic careers, but also if they're in a profession where they have to, you know, do an internship or an externship, it just opens a ton of doors for them. And I tell them, you got to take the time and then really put the effort forth, because there's people that want to help you and they want you to succeed in whatever that is.
Yeah, you know, I agree. You know, the classroom is key, but outside the classroom is just as important, and the people you engage with and develop relationships with, these things don't happen overnight. I had some profoundly amazing memories of people who probably don't even know what kind of, you know, role model they were, you know, or just a kind word in passing can make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's an amazing experience for a lot of people. Can you tell us, the listeners, a little bit about the practice and what you guys do and how you kind of circumvent the athlete or the general patient coming in? And I know you're expanding a little bit where, you know, upper extremity, but now you have a lower extremity orthopedist working for you. So can you tell them a little bit about what you guys do?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, when you look at the field of sports medicine, and I, you know, I would say, you know, that includes the orthopedic surgeon, and there's multiple subspecialties within orthopedics, but it includes all of the people we rely on to help care for the same patients, be it a weekend warrior, my age group, you know, or the, you know, the high school athlete, the collegiate athlete, or the pro and elite athletes. We take care of the spectrum here. But it's a team approach. You know, our athletic trainers are usually first points of contact. Our PTs and OTs are invaluable assets. Our practice is a really, you know, super specialized niche practice in the hand and upper limb world, and we've grown that over the last two decades to really, you know, be, you know, I think a well-known brand, not just locally, but regionally and nationally. We draw from patients from all over the country and even internationally. As you alluded to, we had previously been strictly elbow to fingertips, and wanting to grow the brand, and because of current patients have other needs beyond the elbow and fingertips, we wanted to sort of institute quality control and bring in, you know, the best of the best to help care for the shoulder and lower limb. And that's what we've done over the last 5 to 7 years. You know, we do about 2,000 to 2,200 surgeries as a group. We're quite busy. You know, a daily patient influx into the office probably ranges from 100 to 120 patients between myself and my partners. But we run it really, our core compass is to run the office and treat patients like we want our own families to experience. Mm-hmm. You know, we probably don't have to get into the frustrations of medicine, but, you know, I think everybody's experiencing that in some regard. But we don't believe access should be a challenge, especially for the injured athlete. But that goes for injured grandma, you know, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Acute care is really important. And we're fortunate to be in a city with wonderful allied health professionals that are well-educated in the importance of you know, immediate referral, and that's the level of care we want to provide and continue to provide.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say you guys have been amazing, and the relationship that I've, you know, the experience I've had with you and Dr. Liebman and Dr. Gus, just, and now, you know, when you bring on, you know, the new partners coming in, Dr. Farina, I had met a couple weeks ago. It's amazing. You guys do a great job. If I give you a call and say, hey, I got this athlete that might have a UCL injury, can you get them in? Right away, the office is calling. So I think that's important to know, I think, to the common person that's looking to get access to care. And we talk about this quite often, especially in physical therapy and even in athletic training. If an athlete is injured, anybody, even like you said, someone that's a recreational athlete or a weekend warrior, it doesn't make them any more, it doesn't make them less important, I should say, as like a Tom Brady, or other than them being multi-million dollar employees for an organization. But I think that's what you guys have built. And I see a lot more groups doing that, where they're trying to create access that's better for the patients, so they have a better experience, because it can be certainly life-changing for them. Because we don't know what they deal with outside of when we see them in PT or as a young athlete. Mm-hmm. How does that affect their life? And I think that's what it sounds like you guys are trying to build, is something that is the easiest way for someone to get access. Just like if they went down to a minute clinic, they're coming to you to see the specialist, and that's amazing. I think you guys are doing a great job.
No, we appreciate that. You know, we pride ourselves on that. That's our motto. We want people to feel like they're coming to their second opinion first, you know, where they feel like they're coming into an elite center of excellence for their hand and upper limb and now lower limb care. And the people we bring into the practice are people we feel very strongly about. We've grown organically. You know, we don't advertise. Word of mouth is sometimes the best opportunity to find excellent people. We are biased here, I should say. You know, yeah. Full disclosure, we have brought on people who have only really trained at an institution in New York City called Hospital for Joint Diseases, which is where myself and Liebman have trained, and he and I have been in practice together now 15, 16 years. And even before that, we're in medical school and residency together. So that builds a brand of trust. You know, we're not just, you know, we say this sounds cliche, but we're not just, you know, medical partners. You know, we're much more than that. This is our, you know, we have built this home, so to speak, and anybody mm-hmm. who walks through, we want them to feel like they're walking into something special.
Yeah, I mean, you guys truly deserve it. I think you're, you know, best in class when it comes to, you know, what you guys provide and how you treat the patients that you guys treat. So that's why I'm always, someone asks me, you know, who do I go see for my hand? And, you know, you guys are number one on the list. And just because of the care that you provide, but also the follow-up and the communication is key. Communication back and forth is amazing.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, the communication is key, you know, when I lecture around the city or around the country, you know, I have one slide that has the athlete in the middle of this Ferris wheel, you know, mm-hmm. and all of us are an equal spoke, whether it's the physician, you know, the physical therapist, the occupational therapist, the family, you know, in certain situations, the agent, you know, everybody's got an equal seat at the table, because it's often a very simple but also complicated equation, and having live conversation, good old-fashioned pick up the phone and talk, you know, now it's sometimes pick up the phone and text, but you know, there's somebody on the other end, and it's not days before people are contacted or the plan relayed. That happens often in a very live fashion, and that's a time-consuming endeavor, but it's one we would want our own family member to experience, and I think it's key, and it's the key to success for the patient at the center of that wheel.
Yeah, and I, you know, talking to people daily in practice, it's always, you know, this is what I would do for a family member, or this is what I would try to do to go out of the way for a family member. And quite frankly, I've had people say, well, what would you, if it was your daughter, your son, what would you do? Mm-hmm. And I think we all take that, knowing that they trust our opinion, they know how much we're invested in it, and they respect that decision, and it does. That's going to build a brand for a lot of years to come, and it's going to make you, you know, really the first, you know, first stop when it comes to care.
So, yeah, look, that's verbiage I use every day with my patients, independent of stage of life or activity level. Is, you know, the litmus tests for me in my discussion about treatment recommendations or options or what they would be for a family member sitting across the table. And that goes for whether it's a, you know, D1 athlete with a, you know, with a draft timeline coming up, or you know, the adolescent who getting injured right before they go off to summer camp. You know, the equations are pretty similar.
Yeah, that is great. As far as injuries are, I would say, you know, if we look at injuries in general, especially the hand and you know, from the elbow down, I would say, what's the most common upper extremity injury you see that comes through the door? Now, if we're speaking athlete-related or even general population, what would you say that highest percentage of injury that you see on a week-to-week basis would be?
Yeah, some of it is seasonal, right? You know, football injuries vary and are a bit different from lacrosse injuries or baseball injuries or basketball injuries. But, you know, in general, we all take this for granted a little bit, but the hands are so exposed in all of these sports, you know, even in soccer, which is not a hand dominant sport, you know, sliding and tackling or goalies, the hands are vulnerable in all these sports. So I would think, you know, the more common stuff are thumb injuries, what we generically call skier's thumb, but we certainly see injuries to the UCL on the inside of the thumb throughout the year, independent of mechanism. Finger fractures, whether it's at the tips of the fingers, with or without nail-associated injuries, or phalangeal fractures closer to the hand. Wrist fractures are quite common. And then, you know, the sprain injuries of the fingers, thumb, and wrist are quite common, independent of the age of the athlete or the sport.
Now, surgical procedures, and we talk about these often, and kids always ask if they, you know, if I have to have that procedure, how long is it going to take? And I think it's obviously a case by case, right? We've seen, and you and I have talked about this numerous times with athletes, you know, what would be the easiest procedure for you to manage as a surgeon, or the most complex as well? So it's kind of a two-sided question. So again, I guess it has to do with what the injury is. But if you had someone come in and say, hey, you know what, you hit the lottery, this is going to be pretty easy to recover from, what would you say that would be?
You know, routine wrist fractures, you know, I think are predictable. And I would say in athletes, you know, we can get into this a little bit. You know, there's what the book says in terms of indications, and then that's the science and the data. And then there's the art of it too, which is a major, major factor, you know. So things that we may treat in a cast in others, in the athlete, we may be a bit more apt to fix surgically with a plate or screws so that they have rigid fixation, don't have to do a cast, and they can do early functional training, early conditioning, so that we can maximize their return to play timeline. Certainly those decisions depend on, you know, the stage of life of the, you know, the athlete and their age and their sport, their handedness, their position. These are all things that play a major role. But wrist fractures, I think, are very predictable. I think the thumb, UCL injuries are predictable. Metacarpal fractures, you know, are pretty predictable. And we can supplement some of the things we do that are fairly routine in the OR postoperatively so that, you know, these athletes can, you know, get back on the field pretty quickly. And that's a reflection of surgical technique, surgical implants, which have evolved over the last 10 to 20 years, and rehab protocols.
Yeah, which leads me into the next question is, you know, how does PT align with your practice, and do you have or like to have constant communication with PTs, ATs when they're caring for your patients?
Yeah, you know, so I think language is important. You know, saying that PT and OT are aligned is a no-brainer, but I think it's more than aligned. We're intermeshed. You know, we're fabric, we're woven, because I can't do what I do without people like you and your colleagues, and vice versa. They're inseparable, really. You know, for athletes, often for select injuries, they're starting therapy 48 hours, 72 hours later, dressings down, working on swelling and getting going in a lot of instances to minimize, you know, when the hand is such a delicate organ, it really is an organ, the tendon relationships to the bone and the ligament relationship to the bone, if you don't have good people on the other end who can help manage the rehab immediately, you know, those things get stiff, mm-hmm. swelling persists, and then we get into a situation where the recovery is delayed more than one would expect. So we're intimately intertwined. And I would say so much so that often that plan is discussed not only with the athlete off the bat before the surgical date, but with the therapist who's going to be caring for them right after. So there's no balls dropped. I always say to the patient, my job technically, from a technical perspective, you know, starts and finishes on the day of surgery, but I'm coaching and intimately involved until they're back on the field in an unencumbered way.
Yeah, I mean, that's great to hear, because I know and it's interesting to me, there are some therapists out there, even athletic trainers, that I think developmentally they maybe haven't gotten to the point of the communication being a key primary focus of their practice. And that could just be, it could be generational. It could be also them being, you know, newer to the profession, coming out and being, you know, green, so to speak. But I always, you know, when speaking to staff and other, you know, colleagues and peers, is that, you know, your communication with whomever you're working with, if it's, you know, surgical or non-surgical, they are really kind of the lifeblood to what is happening with the athletes. Constant communication with all of the parties, I think, is key. And I think some are, you know, might be a little hesitant because they feel, I don't know if it's more of an inferiority piece where I'm talking to a surgeon, really, you know, am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to say the wrong thing? But I always find that, you know, working with you and your colleagues, but even other physicians, we're all the same. We're all trying to do the same thing and make sure the athlete or the patient is getting back to what they need to do. So I think asking questions is always key learning, and trying to learn from your peers and also from, you know, you being the surgeon. I think you and I have had numerous conversations about, you know, athletes that are trying to get back to sport too early, or, you know, what the implications can be and what the percentage of failure could be if you go back too early, and what that really means is key. So we can, you know, have those great conversations and learn from them, but also the athlete can learn as to why we're making those decisions in their best interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, you know, I can rattle off names, which we won't on here, but high-level athletes at the collegiate level had an injury, and I suspect this goes for lower limb as well, who ultimately go into one of the fields that they had to be a member of, so to speak, during the rehab program. I had an athlete who became a hand therapist.
Yeah. You know?
I had an athlete who decided to go to medical school late in their collegiate career because of their experience, and has now come back, you know, to be a resident and rotate after a short stint playing professional hockey between college and medical school. It's like, so it's phenomenal. That's the stuff that gives me the greatest joy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's good to see somebody do great after surgery and go back and they give you some signed jersey, you know.
Yeah.
And that's all great. But the real joy, I think, comes from seeing the next generation become inspired because of the interaction they had with somebody like you or myself. And a fire gets ignited, you know, and then it comes full circle. So we're not going to be here forever, you know?
Right. Yeah.
The next people in place to do what we've been doing and do it better. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the teaching is the fun part, right? It's when I get interns, it's teaching them how to be like, you're handing the torch, right? So you're teaching them to become what you are or even better than what you are, and learning a lot of the new techniques and kind of protocols that are out there, so they can become the next, you know, best physical therapist or athletic trainer or surgeon. So, you know, medicine's never going away. It's how do we, you know, revolutionize and keep evolving as, you know, healthcare providers and givers, I should say. So I think that's an important piece, is that mentorship, that teaching is key. And it still goes on. I mean, I still turn to people that I've worked with for years, and even ones that aren't in direct contact with anymore, still call with questions and concerns about certain things. And that's how we continue to learn. So mm-hmm. I think it's important.
Absolutely.
As far as recovery, you know, we look at professional athletes, collegiate athletes, high school athletes. Is there ever a time where the envelope can be pushed. And I think that, you know, I think there's situations where I've talked to athletes, and if, you know, they have an injury and it's a state championship and they're a senior, and, you know, I think there can be some, you know, challenges to that. But also there is that understanding of, you know, we'll try to get you ready for that. But when you're dealing with pro and collegiate athletes, if you have a surgical procedure, when has that become a challenge for you to be able to, you know, make the right decision for that person?
Yeah, so I think it cuts both ways. I just saw a young man right before the Frozen Four who had a finger fracture.
Yeah.
Draft rights were owned by an NHL team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the clinical exam was very much reassuring, although the X-rays, you know, were substantial. We had a lengthy discussion about, hey, if we let you try and play non-operatively, non-operative management, you know, you got your Frozen Four here. You may not, you're probably your last couple of weeks of collegiate hockey before you get, you know, you get pulled to the next level. Or do we fix it strictly, you know, based on the X-rays and know we can rehab you and be a bit more aggressive? But the timeline was not right for surgery unless, you know, the gentleman was willing to miss, you know, the Frozen Four. So, you know, these conversations take time. These are not things that happen in 2 or 3 minutes. And it's initial conversation, and then, you know, an advisor or an agent gets involved, and a parent gets involved. You know, you have to remember, like, at this level, I mean, sometimes these kids are, and I use that word broadly, 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, I mean, they look like grown men, they are, but, you know, emotionally and mentally, sometimes they're not. And understanding who's sitting in front of you and realizing the physicality of a lot of these folks that doesn't always equate with mental maturity is another piece of it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's where I think the art comes into it, how you speak to people comes into it, understanding what their goals are, is key. And it also gets into, like, well, what part of the season are we in? How hard are we going to push? You know, we at the beginning of a collegiate hockey season, and there's, you know, 6 months, you know, to go, and we're going to probably not be as aggressive as we're going to be as if it's, you know, March, you know, and ECACs are coming up or whatever it is. So these are, we deal with this on a daily basis, and I don't take it for granted, you know.
Yeah.
Things that we would do at one point in the season, we would do differently at a different point, or a position plays a role. So we push the envelope. We absolutely do. You know, we're on a subcommittee within the National Hand Surgery Organization about taking care of the elite athlete, because it's a totally different mindset than taking care of others. And it should be. You know, the stakes are different. You know, we could say the stakes are higher financially. They probably are. But lifestyle, you know, not necessarily. But how we care for these folks and the recommendations we make are nuanced. And that's not even getting into the liability factors, you know, which are a whole nother topic about what's at stake here if things go bad.
Yeah, no, 100%. You know, and I deal with the other end of the spectrum. I'm dealing with, you know, high school age athletes, and I might get some collegiate kids that I'll see, but these kids trying to have the conversation about the way I approach it would be, I'm looking at the future for you, you know, so I know what now means to you because you're a 16, 17, 18 year old young athlete, but we have to think about 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, right? So if there's something that we're dealing with that could be life changing for you, then we have to make sure we're looking out for your best interest. And that's where I always turn to you or turn to, you know, one of our other surgeons that's caring for the athlete. And we have a discussion, like you said, we all get together as those caregivers and say, hey, what is in the best interest of this athlete? What's the probability of them having a condition that's going to carry on for years and years and years versus not? And I think, I guess we have to all look at the, you know, the literature and what we see every single day and try to make that decision in the best interest for them. So if, you know, you look at, you know, the young athlete that comes in and sees you, or somebody that wants to come and shadow you and says, hey, Dr. Ruckelsman, you know, I'm really interested in medicine. Not sure which way I want to go. What's your advice for them if they're inspiring to become a physician, whether it be a surgeon or even a general practitioner? Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for them to kind of go that route?
You know, I've heard this question asked in a very similar way, and I've been in the audience, so to speak, listening to how somebody would respond to that. to the point where it's something to the effect, well, if you could do anything else besides medicine, do it. And I hate that answer. I hate it. Because you know what? If you're inspired by it, I say, you know, go for it. Yeah, is clinical medicine hard? Yes. Does it have its challenges? Yes. Are we fortunate to be in this wonderful country and practice? Yes. You know, things that were not a challenge 20 years ago, they're a challenge now. They're going to be different challenges in 20 years from now. But if a young man or woman are inspired, they should go for it. Because I'll tell you what we have learned is that an MD degree, you know, will never be something that's not valued. And if clinical medicine turns out that it's not for you, the pathways in this day and age, what you can do with a medical degree outside of clinical medicine is huge. I mean, there's folks who then go get their MBA, you know, or a PhD and become basic scientists. We need people in the basic sciences. We need people on the business side of medicine, too, in order to survive these challenges. Mm-hmm. Or pharmaceutical consulting or drug development or, you know, entrepreneurship with an MD degree is a huge blossoming field. So, you know, you may not know if you want to practice clinical medicine or what specialty you want to practice, but if you're inspired by the field of medicine, I mean, you go for it.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's an important message because I think a lot of, you know, young, you know, rising academic young teenagers or even young adults, I think, shy away from challenge. I think, again, you have to challenge yourself. I always say education's never wasted. And you do. You have to go out and at least try it and see if it's something that's going to work out for you. And then with medicine, the good thing about medicine and science, you always have some lateral movement, right? So like you said, you could become a clinical scientist or a clinical doctor or become someone that works in, you know, more of the research or work on the business side of things, where I know a couple MDs that went on to become, you know, got their MBAs and went on the business side of things. Mm-hmm. To kind of close out tonight, because I know you're very busy and I appreciate you coming on tonight, especially, you know, late after a long day and actually probably a long week. This is kind of an interesting question. I like to ask it because I want to see the reaction of the guest is if you met your 18 or 20 year old self today, what would you tell him? Maybe some advice or anything that you would maybe do differently in your journey to get to where you are today?
I would have said, it's a great question. I would have said take a little bit more time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found a fairly traditional pathway. I went college, medical, you know, high school, college, medical school. I never did a semester abroad. I never took a gap year, you know. And so, you know, short of not being somebody who was in an academic position to finish college in 3 years or do medical school in 3 years. I went straight through 4-4-4, and then I did my 5 years, you know, 5 year residency and a year fellowship. And, you know, then I started right away. I didn't travel. You know, I grew up in a very blue collar family, you know, didn't have resources where there was, you know, extra money to do those things. And that was just my reality. So I never did it, you know? But I think, you know, once you start to practice clinical medicine, it's hard to stop. It's hard to sort of create that space to live, you know, beyond your career. And so I think, you know, it's great to be focused, but I think you got to breathe a little bit. It prevents burnout. It gives you an appreciation for other cultures and other cities and other parts of the world. And I think being a well-rounded person is only going to make you a better doctor.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I have to agree because I kind of did the same thing where, you know, I rushed, get to college, get finished, start working. You know, my education was 5 years at Northeastern and then I went back in and got a master's and then I got another master's. So for me, it was like always trying to keep getting things, you know, completed so I can start. And I think that's the one thing our culture has always been is I think hurry up and wait, you know, hurry up, get there, do your thing. And then where other cultures around the country do take time and they do those other things. So that was well put. Well, I know your time is precious. I appreciate it. I appreciate the relationship that we have and what you do for the patients that we send over to you guys. And I hope that lasts for a long time and you guys keep growing.
God willing, it will. It's a privilege and an honor to, you know, work together with you and your folks. I look, every day. I bet you do as well. I feel very fortunate. It's been hard work, but labor of love. I couldn't do anything else.
Well, again, I appreciate it, Dr. Ruckelsman.
My pleasure. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you for tuning in to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This is your creator and host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X under AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Stay tuned for our next episode.